Jesse, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much, Jake.
My pleasure. Super simple question to start with. What are you most excited about working on today?
Today, I'm really excited about bringing stablecoins to the Lightning Network. I think basically putting together all of the information necessary to get people excited about bringing other assets onto Bitcoin and having in-flight currency exchange.
Wow.
There's a lot to dive into there.
Yeah, absolutely. And that wasn't the answer I was expecting, which is particularly cool. Let's start here. So stablecoins, what are they? And why would it be useful to have them on the Lightning Network?
Yeah. So stablecoins are tokens that basically enable any merchant to be able to receive payments over the internet, just like they would receive Bitcoin, but they don't have to worry about volatility. Now, when you have stablecoins, there are some trust considerations. But overall, it means that, you know, you're trusting an issuer of a currency, just like you're trusting the US dollar. But now you have the technology upgrade that we've all been enjoying with Bitcoin and Lightning.
Cool. And I personally don't use stablecoins all that much. Just thinking about my personal use case, which is always helpful with this kind of thing, right? But and that's because I'm not too pissed off with the Australian dollar, which is where I now live, having grown up in the UK. And so I'm happy to use the fiat banking rails for general day-to-day life purposes. But there was incredible traction with stablecoins all around the world in different countries. And that classic phrase of like, check your financial privilege. People don't have access to bank accounts. People don't have access to US dollars. People don't have access to all of these different financial services. And a stablecoin comes along and they're like, hang on, I don't have short-term volatility risk here. Boom. And talk to me then about the kind of person that loves this product as they are today.
Yeah, the type of people that love it are really, you know, businesses, especially people and businesses that have expenses denominated in fiat. If you've got fiat expenses like rent, well, then you can't stomach any of the volatility that a lot of the Bitcoin investors really love, because it, you know, that volatility means that their savings are generally going up. But if you have a drawdown, and you know, Bitcoin is known for this, where it, you know, occasionally crashes by 30, sometimes 80%, you know, a business isn't equipped to stomach that type of volatility. They still have their expenses, they still have to make payroll. So that's really the fit for stablecoins.
Mm. Interesting. Okay. And I mean, I have so many questions for you, Jesse. Let's try to do a bit of a journey, shall we say. So like, how did you come across this problem, and why is it the most exciting thing you're working on today?
I came across this problem because we've been working on Bitcoin and improving the payment experience when using Bitcoin. And trying to answer this question of why are we having so much difficulty getting merchant adoption of Bitcoin payments? Mm. And by asking the questions of really what's holding you back from doing this, the payment processing is so good with Bitcoin, with Lightning added to it, but why aren't we seeing everybody accept payments? And it kept on coming up that merchants are afraid of volatility. They want to be able to receive payments at a low cost, be able to pay their employees, their team members, their vendors, without having to think about the payment system so much. Mm. I think where we're at right now today is that merchants are paying payment processors quite a lot, you know, over 3% often. And they also have to bear this risk of chargebacks. And here I come in telling them about, you know, all of the magic that Bitcoin payments can offer. And then they simply ask me the question of, well, can I, like, how do I sell it? I'm like, why would you want to sell it? And I have to put my morals aside, but and really get down to the heart of it. And the reality is that they have a whole bunch of expenses that are denominated in dollars that they need to pay, and they need to pay simply so that they can just continue to operate their business and not be, I don't know, caught up in all the magic and the excitement of the technology, but it's really just brass tacks. I need to pay my people, and I need to do so reliably.
It's very interesting, and not to draw it away from the business use case you mentioned, but I'm currently in the middle of having purchased a house, working on a renovation, and I'm looking at potential quotes and different CapEx coming up in the relatively near term, like 3 to 6 months. And my wife's like, well, where's Bitcoin going to be? And I'm like, anyone's guess. She's like, make a prediction. I'm like, well, it'll be wrong. And in a very small way, that's similar to what you're talking about, because it's like the short-term volatility is such that you don't know. And in my instance, I think the most comfortable position is just to simply DCA out when you need the cash. But you do run the risk of a drawdown. And what does that mean? And maybe you're better off to take 50% off the table now and use that and set it aside. And then, you know, if you get some upside, then that 50% is not as expensive as you thought it was. With a business that every single month has CapEx, that would be even more acute as a problem when it comes to funding. So, yeah, really interesting to think that through. And so another angle to this that strikes me as cool as well is... I've studied before and I really resonate with this. Like the wider crypto market is, generally speaking, highly speculative software projects and very different to Bitcoin. And any Bitcoin maxi will bang on about what is money and blah, blah, blah. And I love all that. But I also like this idea that actually the crypto market is a testing ground for everything that might one day end up on top of Bitcoin. And what you're describing is exactly that, because stablecoins, like them or not, have found product market fit because they are flying in terms of capacity, adoption, and different ones coming to market. So is that just this process playing out, do you think?
I really like that kind of framing of this, that we have watched stablecoins proliferate on crypto generally, but it's not happening on Bitcoin. And seeing the numbers coming from Tether that, you know, $20 trillion was transacted in stablecoins last year. And 10 of those were on Tether. But then you look deeper and you see that the biggest blockchain that these stablecoins operate on is Tron, which is like basically as centralized as you could get. And I also looked at the transaction fees and I see that the transaction fees on Tron are rising exponentially, where it's $3 to $6 per transaction. And that's more than you would pay on Bitcoin. That's certainly more than you would pay on the Lightning Network. So it was really kind of asking this question of like, why isn't this happening on Bitcoin? Like what's being preferred about these more centralized, less robust, less reliable blockchains that all of these stablecoin activity is happening on those other blockchains? And basically, you know, me being kind of a Bitcoin maxi, I'm thinking, why do we need a second blockchain? What purpose does it actually serve? So recognizing that Bitcoin is capable and would actually be very good at serving these stablecoin use cases because of some of the innovations done by Lightning Labs through Taproot Assets. So you can actually create these other tokens and really remove the blockchain out of the conversation. It's not, there's no tech advancement. It's just a separate token and you do have a trusted issuer. So Bitcoin is now capable of doing stablecoins and stablecoins at scale using Lightning.
And so are there any examples of that available in the market today?
No, there's not. So
not a single one. Wow.
So that's what makes me most excited about it, because wow, I'm going around communicating this opportunity.
Come on, Jesse, let's go. Yeah.
Like here's a golden opportunity for you to move $20 trillion worth of activity per year onto Bitcoin and have it be extremely reliable. And you not have to worry about Justin Sun behind Tron doing something weird or the government shutting it down. Now you've just got a token that's moving on Bitcoin, which is extremely reliable. It's globally available. It's easy to access. You're benefiting from the scalability of the Lightning Network. We're kind of at the center of everything. And it makes me very excited to communicate the first mover advantage that is available to anybody that wants to kick this into high gear.
Cool. And so one of the big parts of the last like 5 years plus for me has been going down the Austrian economics rabbit hole and having done a business management degree, you know, never asked the question, what is money? And suddenly it's like, oh, sound money is actually a really useful tool. And low time preference thinking is really useful. And actually it's about human action and praxeology. I had Hubertus the Austrian on the podcast. Gosh, I can't remember what episode number now, but he had some excellent points around how free banking works in an Austrian environment. And having been extremely like radicalized by the concept of a fixed monetary supply, I spoke with Hubertus, and actually he completely opened my eyes to what's possible in terms of some of the bottlenecks of a truly fixed money supply. And so anyone listening, go and check out Hubertus's content. There's a couple of YouTube videos, very, very good, and equally the episode I did. But why is it bad if someone has access to a fixed money supply, they can say, okay, I'm going to give you exposure to a bunch of things I print with this in the background, and you can go and use it as you wish. And in one sense, it could be just one business to another saying, okay, you're supposed to be supplying me some raw materials, some logs, some iron ore, some whatever. I don't have the money for it right now. Here's an IOU. Once I've created the product and sold it, you'll get paid. And that debt contract is, in a sense, a form of money. And you can build them on top of the limited fixed supply at the very base. And it's this idea of moving away from what currently exists, which is a totally debt-based credit circulating economy, where basically someone just prints it, calls it debt, sticks it on an asset balance sheet, and you know, you're off to the races. It's like, well, hang on, that isn't anything when you really get down to the base of it. And hence we've got this crazy scenario of having to print more money just to pay the interest, and it's fine except for the fact that anyone trying to save in that currency is getting absolutely screwed. And so the idea of stable coins on top of Bitcoin actually to me is something I'm completely open to. Because yes, the short-term volatility problem is completely real, as we've discussed, but actually it still fits within that Austrian lens of base case or base money is fixed. And so if you go and give away too many extra tokens on top of that to someone else who then fails and you don't get them returned and you're exposed to the base layer, you're swimming naked, essentially. And so your due diligence on who you might loan to or who you might give your stablecoin to goes up because you want to get them back. Otherwise, you don't get your Bitcoin. And so there's a really interesting play here where that kind of all comes together. Anything resonate there, Jesse? And have you looked at that kind of stuff from Hubertus?
Absolutely. I love talking to Hubertus. Yeah. So we've been,
what a legend.
We got connected through the Riga Baltic Honey Badger conference. Cool. But he makes a great point. Because right now, the system that we're operating in is completely addicted to debt. There's far more dollar-denominated debt than there are dollars in existence, which doesn't really make sense. That means that the dollar could die not in inflation, but could die in deflation if, you know, we basically don't have enough dollars to pay back all that debt. Mm. So, okay, we need a different system that actually has, that's more honest. And so this is where we would introduce a Bitcoin standard. But on top of that solid foundation of Bitcoin, of trustlessness, well, we can build a debt-based system and a credit system on top of it. But at the base of it, it still remains truth. So if you're going to do loans, for example, well, you're going to want to do loans and things that are not Bitcoin. Because one, well, you really can't afford to lose your Bitcoin if someone doesn't pay you back. I don't think any of us Bitcoiners are willing to put up with that risk. But also, we don't want our debt denominated in Bitcoin either, because I may never be able to repay that.
Mm.
So what we're left with is, you know, I actually want dollar denominated or some other currency denominated debt when talking about a credit system. And that's actually consistent with, I believe it's called Gresham's Law, which is saying the best money is actually kept in stores, you know, kept in your vault. But the worst money is actually circulating much more rapidly. And we're seeing that is very consistent with the stablecoin adoption that we're seeing today. Mm. It is worse money than Bitcoin, but we're seeing it circulate much more. And so when we're looking at Bitcoin as a medium of exchange, we want Bitcoin to be that store of value, be a medium of exchange, and be open to the idea that anybody will receive whatever currency they want and be able to cater to that massive market. I don't want Bitcoin to miss out on the opportunity of being the medium of exchange for the world. Mm. And in order to serve that, we're going to have to bring in other tokens.
Mm. And it immediately gets me thinking, Jesse. So, you know, there was a reason that you had gold coins, silver coins, bronze coins. You know, that tiered feature set, essentially, where, like, you know, on the gold end, really good at store of value, but not so great at moving across space. Whereas actually, you could use different commodity monies to perform the smaller transactions at a lower cost per payment, essentially. And maybe that's what we're seeing here, being built out as like a blended set of tools on top of Bitcoin that's replaced gold. And so, yeah, it strikes me then, do you think if Bitcoin's the base case blockchain, and then you've got Lightning on top of that as a layer two, which is using Bitcoin as collateral, and we can run through what the Lightning Network does, but then there's going to be another set of tokens on top of that. Do you think that if those tokens, let's say that's the equivalent of bronze, are they still, as a medium of exchange, it's still Bitcoin performing medium of exchange as a feature of money, do you think? Or is that more of like a suite of products? So like, how best do we think about it, do you think?
Yeah. Some of this is non-intuitive. Actually, most of this is non-intuitive. But basically,
very few Bitcoin... people get what Bitcoin is, right? It's not intuitive initially. It's hard, but once you see it, you can't unsee it.
Yeah. Bitcoin is trustless, and that's the main piece. So when you're talking about creating infrastructure, which is the Lightning Network, instead of just making a single Bitcoin transaction, I'm going to create a Lightning channel, which allows me to actually move value across this trustless channel. And once I have that set up, then when we introduce new tokens into this, what Taproot Assets enables us to do over the Lightning Network is in-flight currency exchange. So the payment may begin as one currency, move over trustless rails through Bitcoin, and then exchange at the end, that last hop, into another currency of whatever someone wants to receive. And it allows us to have a completely trustless payment system and then still be compatible with all of the currencies that we want at the edges.
Interesting. And so to be very clear, trustless is essentially the ability to transact, whether you are receiving, sending, or saving, and no one getting in the way.
That's right. You're keeping self-custody, you know, basically nobody can stop you from doing this. There aren't people taking exorbitant fees. You can participate however you would like to do and not have to worry about, you know, someone taking the value that you've saved.
Brilliant. And there are a whole number of reasons why that's important. It's not a direction I want to go in right now necessarily, but where I am keen to learn more, and this is where I thought the thrust of today's conversation would be around like the economics of a Lightning node. And it's to frame where I'm at, which is the very, very start of this process, investment background, managing my own capital over a multi, well, over 10 years of trying different things, essentially landed at Bitcoin is the thing for long-term, multi-generational store of value. And it's then a case of trying to ignore absolutely everything that you see come up, because the shiny different objects that appear and you're like, oh, that might beat Bitcoin, the hurdle rate, or this might be a good bet. And before you know it, you've put some money into something that's called a treasury company and it's trading terribly versus what Bitcoin actually did. And you're like, well, that was a mistake, but a good lesson. So in terms of the Lightning Network and running a node, I have recently become a Albi Hub subscriber. And so I'm using Albi and I have a couple of nodes and channels. I have a node with a couple of channels open. And I'm really interested in the Lightning Network from a perspective of a capital allocation. So, okay, I don't have Bitcoin, the hurdle rate, as an exposure when I'm earning in sats. That's a brilliant start. You know, when you're buying an equity at a fiat denominated number, you're making a bet that that fiat number is going to be higher at some point in the future when you can actually get liquidity for it. Whereas earning in sats is like magic. Great. I don't have that problem any longer. But then it's like, what custody risk am I taking? Am I having to give the Bitcoin to someone else that's apparently going to give it back to me? Like some of these loan products, for example, you're having to give them a whole Bitcoin to only get 50% loan to value in fiat. It's like, well, hang on. What happens if the Bitcoin price rockets and I just never get the Bitcoin pie? But that's a difficult trade to make in some senses. So yeah, just run me through the Lightning Network itself and how it's developed over time and what the economics of it are. Because when you're like stablecoins coming to Lightning, I'm like, wow, massive volume, capital required, can be done in self-custody and potentially a yield in sats, which is maybe where this is all going. But yeah, fascinated.
Yeah. So when you're thinking about Bitcoin, I think everybody knows that there's a limit. 7 transactions per second is really what Bitcoin is capable of doing. But when you actually go to pay, it's going to take at least 10 minutes on average just to get one confirmation, actually make a payment happen. So we need Bitcoin to be more scalable and we need it to be faster. So that was really the genesis of the Lightning Network. How can we make Bitcoin more scalable, faster to transact, cheaper to transact, and also not disrupt the decentralization that Bitcoin has, not introduce trust into the system? So that's really where Lightning Network fits. And what actually happens is that you're taking your Bitcoin and you're connecting it to someone else and creating a joint account is how I like to think about it. So I'm putting Bitcoin into a channel. I share it with someone else and we're both signing the payout with every transaction that happens over this channel, this side ledger to Bitcoin's blockchain. So if both of us sign, well, we can each leave without the other's permission and take it to the Bitcoin blockchain and leave this relationship and get our Bitcoin back. I don't need to talk to you in order to exit this channel, which is really nice. So I have unilateral exit power with Lightning. But when I'm creating this Lightning channel, it actually provides a benefit to you because it allows you, as well as me, to actually transact in a very seamless way and faster and cheaper. And so there's situations where you might actually pay me to open a Lightning channel to you just because it creates useful infrastructure. Just like if you're running a store, well, you might pay someone to build a road to your store so that, you know, customers can access it. So that's a situation. So there's economics where with every payment that goes through this Lightning channel, I can earn a fee. And I can also earn a fee if someone is paying me to open a Lightning channel to them. So that's two ways that you can earn sats by using your Bitcoin as infrastructure for payments.
It's a really cool picture to start painting because there's that whole anarcho-capitalist world, it's like, you know, the pushback is who will build the roads, you know? And it's like, well, we will. And this is the example. And it immediately makes me think, you know, the piece of real estate that is not connected to the road network versus the piece of real estate that is connected to the road network, they're different capital propositions. And it's very clear that the second of those two is more valuable because of the trade that can then be done. So how many lightning nodes exist? How many lightning channels exist? And how is that market growing? Because if there's $20 trillion worth of stablecoin that could end up being transacted using this infrastructure, like, where are we at? You know, there's not even a stablecoin on Lightning yet, right? So this is the very start.
I'm debating pulling up the actual figures, but I know some of them off the top of my head.
Well,
so
take a second if you want, no problem.
Yeah. Okay, right now, on Amboss.space, I can see that there are 15,139 nodes active. And those are just public nodes. You can have a private node as well. Now, you asked about channels. There's 46,000 channels that are active. So these are the individual connections, and that's what's public. But you can also have private channels. And then what we don't know completely is how much payment activity is happening. But we've been running Lightning nodes with our Rails product, you know, for other people, for customers that don't give up custody. They keep self-custody, but we get to see the actual transaction volume that is going through that. And we're seeing out of the 29 Bitcoin that we've deployed, to date, we've routed 62 Bitcoin. So really, there's not that much Bitcoin that is actually required to move an incredible amount of value, you know, since we launched it in July.
Wow. And just talk me through what that actually means then. So the capital position, that was a metric of, okay, here's the pool of capital. And then here's the amount of payment value that was supplied by that pool of capital, which is almost 3x the deployed capital.
Yeah, you could think of it in terms of velocity. So yes, the forwards volume that we've done in this cluster of nodes is twice the value of the capital that is in there.
Wow.
And that's in about 6 months' time. So cool, that tells me that the velocity is about 4.
Mm. And it's just, these are the kind of things that just blow your mind, don't they? We are living through history being written. You know what I mean? Like, this is a new money and it's being built in ways that no one envisaged even 5 years ago. And yeah, it's like, this is what happens if you give people an aligned incentive, a base network through which everyone shares and the value accrued to that network. Let's build it. And it takes time and things don't work. But that's okay, because what comes out of it is more robust. How many Bitcoin did you say that you guys have helped deploy? 15?
30 Bitcoin is about what we've 30, deployed.
Right 30 now. Deployed and 60-something moved. Yeah. Okay, wow. Yeah, so 30 Bitcoin doesn't sound like all that much, but when you think about the fiat number, it's quite big. And I'm then wondering about, like, the total market size. Like, how many other people are actually actively doing this at this point?
Well, yeah, given that there's 15,000 nodes, there's not that many that are actually participating. Mm. It's relatively small, but it still is highly decentralized.
Mm.
And what we've done is made it very easy for people to start to participate, but we also have to balance how much demand is there for payment volume on the Lightning Network. I don't want to deploy a ton of capital because then the rewards would dwindle. So I really have to balance the supply of Bitcoin versus the demand for payments on Bitcoin.
And I guess this is where the point about building stable coins on Lightning is cool, because it's like, okay, if we did have all this extra demand, then this is how it would function on the back end. And this is how that piece of economics actually fits into it. Okay. And I love this. It's taken kind of half an hour to get to this point. So what would it look like to actually build a stable coin? And why would I use your stable coin built on Bitcoin and Lightning instead of, you know, a Tether token USDT with Tron in the background?
Yeah. Well, the nice thing about it is it's completely permissionless. So you can create your own token. I can create my own token. We can all have our own stable coin. But I think with recent legislation, the Genius Act specifically, it's really opened the floodgates. So all of these regulated institutions, basically every fintech, is issuing their own stablecoin. We're seeing it happen live. You know, Stripe just released their Tempo blockchain that's going to be focused on stablecoins. You know, we've got Tether in the mix. We've got USDC. Revolut just announced a stablecoin.
Wow.
It seems like this is all happening at once. But it's all happening because we've witnessed what is happening with Tether, where Tether buys U.S. treasuries to fix our debt problem in the U.S. And they're getting the rest of the world to buy U.S. treasuries via these USDT tokens. So the rest of the world gets dollar stability, and the U.S. gets more people to buy its debt, and Tether and stablecoins are the vehicle to distribute it to the world. But with all of these different stablecoins coming to market, we're introducing an interoperability problem, because the blockchains that are being introduced don't talk well to each other, which is necessary to how do we link them all together? And how do we form a network of value that can transact seamlessly? So that is really what's being done. I think which stablecoin are you going to choose is really about the reputability of the issuer. Do I have they built a brand of, you know, trust and reputability? Have they built the transparency tools? And a lot of the custodians within the space actually have built that. They have that trust. They have the transparency. They've got, they've survived audits. So I can see a lot of people navigate and gravitate towards those custodian issued stablecoins. We'll see if governments start issuing and CBDCs. Do we trust a government more than we trust a custodian? That's an open question. But what I do know for sure is that there's so many stablecoins out there that there's going to be a need to interoperate between these. If you want your stablecoin to actually be used, well, plug it into the Lightning Network so that I can have in-flight currency exchange and you can get paid in whatever token you prefer.
And so is the product, Jesse, actually more of a B2B play rather than B2C, and build infrastructure for the likes of Revolut and Stripe to have their own blockchains with their own stablecoin, but then this is how they're going to talk to each other?
Yeah, this is very much B2B focus, but you know, my goal is to really bring the Lightning Network to everybody so that everybody is just using the Bitcoin system. We're building on a Bitcoin standard. We've got this neutral currency that is interfacing between all these currencies at the edges. And that Bitcoin is at the center of all of this activity. And that all of that is going through the Lightning Network, and it's rewarding savers to create payments infrastructure in a decentralized way that's different from Visa, MasterCard, PayPal.
Yeah, hell yeah. And that's exactly what I would like to see built as well. Like, just from a shared vision perspective, I would use a product that was built like that. And, you know, the likes of Stripe, for example, obviously an absolute mammoth business that is the back end of a huge payments layer on the traditional internet. the likes of Shopify, like for sure they'll bring something out, right? ShopPay, Alibaba, they'll all get involved. But what will they do? Well, their incentive will be to actually be the complete opposite. Like it'll be a centralized blockchain. It'll be a way to monitor exactly who does what when. And to it'll probably be, as I think about it, packaged up as some kind of safety thing. It's like, oh, you should use our blockchain because we can ensure that you don't have any scanners, or do you know what I mean? And it'll actually be a surveillance tool. And that's not what the world needs, is more financial surveillance. It's the complete opposite. So in some ways, I could see a situation actually where, you know, Bitcoin is the ultimate example of a bottom-up, viral, organic adoption in terms of a technology. And it's how many people even 10 years ago described, like, if there was a new type of money, this is probably how it would look. And it's happening. I wouldn't be surprised if a stablecoin went through a similar process. Do you think that's kind of a likely outcome? And it might take 10 years to have the most successful stablecoin, but the point is from the very, very start, like, because Tether, for example, you're still trusting Tether. I've never seen Tether's open book balance sheet to say how many US treasuries they've got. No one's ever seen that. It's a private company. Apparently they made 20 fucking trillion or whatever. I don't even know what the number is. What, I must want to look that up. They're the most profitable business per person in the world, according to them. And I don't know a lot about the business, but it's still that process, isn't it? It's like, if you started now and built something truly transparent from the start with Bitcoin and Lightning underneath it, that's a much better fit.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of news actually happening around Tether, the company, and looking at their balance sheet. How many US treasuries do they actually have? Whereas the Genius Act requires 1-to-1. So yes, for every token, you've got the US treasuries to back it up. So that's happening. But of course, there's open questions about, you know, should they only hold US treasuries? Because Tether, the company, actually holds Bitcoin and gold. In significant quantities. They really keep the US treasuries necessary to meet their obligations, because they're hedging their bets on interest rates declining, which would have a direct impact on Tether's revenues. For the evolution of things, we've watched Tether issue on many different blockchains and having to invest a lot of resources in how those blockchains interoperate and how you can have Tether zero on how these tokens can move from one blockchain to another, because that's been a major sticking point for them. And we've watched Tether hop from blockchain to blockchain looking for cheaper and cheaper transactions. And the reality is that even Solana, which touts its scalability, is only doing 17,000 transactions per second. And if we want to serve the economy of the future, which is a machine economy and using AI, where you're having one payment per AI query, we have to think about the scalability that that will require. And what we saw from Stripe and their Tempo blockchain is they're promising 100,000 transactions per second. And if we compare that, just to benchmark it a bit, to Google search queries, how many Google searches are done per second? It's 189,000.
Wow.
So Tempo needs to scale double that. Solana cannot do it. No blockchain can actually serve one payment per Google search, but the Lightning Network can, because it can do 40 million transactions per second.
Can it? That's my next question. So what kind of volume can the Lightning Network do?
So, yeah, this is easily 10,000 times what, you know, the next best blockchain can do. Are you kidding
me right now? I've never heard this metric before. So not like 100x faster, 10,000 times faster.
That's right.
Fuck. That's a game changer. And so why have I not heard that information before? I don't know. Anyway, please teach me why the Lightning Network is able to do that volume of payments per second.
Well, there's a couple of different reasons. One is there's no central database that holds all of the globe's transactions. So So why is Bitcoin slow? It's because it takes 10 minutes for the entire globe to arrive at a source of truth and have a shared history. Like, that's why there's a block time delay. But the Lightning Network doesn't have a shared ledger of all the transactions. It's side ledgers. It's a network of side ledgers called payment channels. It's a payment channel network. And that technology allows it to scale horizontally instead of doing a bigger and bigger and more centralized blockchain. Now you've got, 46,000 micro ledgers that are all happening at once. So this payment channel network behind the Lightning Network is actually what makes it capable of reaching this massive scale and not having to rely on proof of work in order to get the entire globe aligned.
Really cool. And it makes me think about the traditional banking system and how like historically this became about. The growth of the telecommunications infrastructure was such that you could suddenly make a phone call. And if you could make a phone call to someone on the other side of the world that you trusted, and you said, listen, mate, you keep this money for this person and I'll keep this money for this person, and let's not actually physically send gold to each other because that's way too expensive. And it threw petrol on the fire of, you know, why should we have a paper currency on top of gold? Well, that's precisely why. What does that result in? Well, you've got these big commercial banks, also the payments companies, and they are collecting together lots of IOUs every single day. And at the end of the day, they do an interbank transfer. And that's essentially what Lightning is doing on top of Bitcoin. As and when people close their channels, they say, okay, look, I'm ready to get out of here. And as you already described, you can do so by your own choice. You don't have to go to your channel providing partner and go, oh, by the way, I'm finished with this. Can we agree to, like, you know, annul the contract or whatever? You can just leave. Would that be a fair analogy, do you think, in terms of that kind of the payment layer that we currently use and is considered like the status quo is already abstracted away from the real value? And so that's really what Lightning is doing on top of Bitcoin.
Yeah, the current system is relying on all of the assessments that...
All the trust.
You know, do I trust you as a consumer? Will you pay me back at the end of the month? And also it's relying on trust in the banks that are transferring this money. You know, I've authorized this transaction and now I'm going to debit your account at another bank and I'll pay a fee for this and have to rely on that other bank to actually maintain solvency, which is a massive question because of course the bank has a tiny reserve ratio and they've loaned out all of their money. You know, we're at a point in the system where the global liquidity is extremely low. And so many banks are at risk for bank runs, where you could withdraw all your funds and the bank may not have the cash on hand to actually meet its obligations because most of it is loaned out. And so this kind of sets up an entirely trusted system. And it's more important than ever that we move away from that, especially because we've got additional geopolitical upset that could really just throw the whole thing into chaos. And, you know, Bitcoin, its heart beats every 10 minutes and will continue to do so reliably. It's more reliable than AWS at this point. So we need that firm infrastructure on which to build our future society and prepare us for the future.
It's so cool, Jesse. You're filling me with optimism and also ideas. As I was listening to you, I thought back to my last comment about abstracting the payment layer away from the real value. And actually, that's not true. That's not what Lightning is doing. Bitcoin is the real value. And Lightning is a representation of Bitcoin built in such a way that there isn't any requirement for trust. So it's not an abstraction of Bitcoin. It's actually just another form of Bitcoin.
It is Bitcoin. Lightning, right? Lightning does not introduce a new token itself. Yes, you can move other tokens over Lightning, as it described, but Lightning itself is a contract between two people about how their Bitcoin, their shared Bitcoin in this contract, should actually be managed. Really, that's all it is. And it also provides a protocol of how those contracts can interact. And so one payment can hop from party to party to party in a way that nobody has complete knowledge of all of the payments. Mm. This is our escape out of the panopticon. Mm. And it's also a bet on the future of efficiency and decentralized power, because this is a network and networks are powerful.
Mm. They're so powerful. Okay, Jesse, a few questions I'd love to get to now. You've been building a business for a number of years now. What's that process been like for you?
It's been such a journey. I never thought that I would be capable of, you know, running a business. And it was a humbling experience, because, you know, I went into this knowing nothing really. And, you know, my future co-founder, you know, asking me, have you ever thought of starting a business? And it hadn't even crossed my mind. Mm. But like, you know, working in the fiat system, you know, people would, you know, trust me, give me more responsibility. And, you know, so of course, you know, you're kind of working your way up. But when you're starting a company, you're the top. There's no one really that you can delegate it to at the beginning. So you have to do everything. And being a generalist, you know, I may not have had like the best grades, you know, all through school, but what I've learned is that I'm actually a good operator, that, you know, that generalist skill set that we've done from doing little things here and there can actually all be applied, and you can run a solid organization, you know, without having to be really rich or be super smart. But really, you can kind of put together your skill set to be empathetic and be able to understand other people's pain and suffering and be able to design a product that addresses it. So really starting a business was the start of it. Putting together a presentation, I never realized how valuable a presentation could be on being able to communicate your ideas. But we went to El Salvador shortly after the legal tender law. Mm-hmm. And so this was our first AMBOSS presentation. And that's when the venture capitalists approached us, be like, what is this AMBOSS thing? And I think we had a lot of excitement, and we've carried that momentum. And now into a state where we're ready to scale, and we're looking for the next investor partners to take us that next leg of the journey. But thankfully, we had phenomenal backers in our early stages with Stillmark to help us make sense of all the data of payment channel networks, be able to apply it, bring AI into the picture, to have fully automated operations doing very complex tasks in order to make this payment system work.
Wow. Yeah. Early stage capital in some ways is a runway to product market fit. Like, the more efficient you can be with that early stage money, which is an idea, it's people. It's like, cool idea. This is exactly what I invest in. Go. But then how long can you make that money last? What do you find along the way? It's a bet, basically. So can you share any moments where you're like, oh, this is really hard?
I think for early stage, just meeting with folks and figuring out what in the heck is the venture capital process? How do I actually raise an investment round? What do I put in my pitch deck, and who do I talk to? And there's really no good information to say how to do it. You know, I spent, you know, countless hours watching YouTube videos and reading venture deals in order to get some sense of how this process goes. But it wasn't really until I did it that I became to understand that it is relationship building, and the early stage venture, the most valuable ones, really become part of your team. It's if you can use them right, if you get the right strategic investor, it's giving you a leg up because it's not just a check. It is them being involved and being supportive. And I think I was really afraid to have my first board meeting. I think I can share that.
Yeah.
I thought that this was, this is where investors come to grill you on all of the mistakes that you've made as you're learning this process.
Sweating.
And like what even goes into a board deck. But what I know now is, you know, a board meeting is where you get the smartest minds together to work on the hardest problem. And your job as a founder is surface the information, the information that you are seeing in your day to day that makes this the hardest problem, and equips your board with enough information to be informed and be strategic to you to help you devise a plan and devise a strategy. So it's been an incredible journey, on that, just to get to that stage, to realize, you know, all these people are here to support me, not here to tear me down, because we're all part of a team here. We've all got money and time invested in this, and we want it to be successful.
Really cool. Because people don't often talk about those like smaller moments where it's actually quite a big deal to you, but oh my God, I've got to do a board meeting. Like what even happens? You're the CEO, mate. What's going on here?
Yeah. But you know, I think we've attracted investors that are that like the fact that, you know, we're humble founders. We do have to figure things out, but we're here to learn, open to feedback. And yeah, we're here to fix the world financial system. And what an exciting project to work on. So
Absolutely. That's
the reward.
And so Jesse, are you actively doing a financing round now or soon to be in the future?
Let's see. I'll probably answer that after the call, but
okay.
Overall,
that's okay. No pressure, because it can be kind of sensitive as well. And that's what I'm conscious of. I'll keep it very, very simple. How does Amboss make money?
Yeah. Amboss is a liquidity coordinator. So we've got all of this decentralized network, all of these different nodes, and they each have Bitcoin, but who do they connect to? And solving that problem, we solved it using a marketplace. And that marketplace is called Magma. It's a liquidity marketplace. It was really the first one that was out there that anybody could access. And it's been active for about 5 years now. And through Magma, that liquidity marketplace, Amboss earns a fee, which is, you know, 0.05% of the infrastructure that is being created. But at scale, that becomes a massive, massive number. If we're looking at replacing the foreign exchange market through this decentralized coordination, that's really where we're focused. So Amboss makes money from coordinating liquidity. And we also have other business lines, but that is the key.
Awesome. And so it's the Magma liquidity marketplace for the Lightning Network. So if you're running a Lightning node and you want to add some liquidity and open a channel, then Magma is one of the places you can do that.
Yep. If you want to get connected, you basically go to the marketplace and you can buy it from, you know, any other participant on the network and pay their asking prices.
Yeah, this is where I've been playing around with LB Hub lately and looking at opening channels. And I saw Amboss pop up and I'm like, oh my God, look at all these different names. And I had no idea like this even existed essentially. So I'm at the very start of this journey, but it's really catching my attention. And something you just said then as a venture investor is like big idea. So how do you disrupt the foreign currency markets?
Well, one piece is actually bringing other assets into the Lightning Network. And so that's why I'm excited about pitching people on bringing their stablecoin onto Bitcoin and accelerating it using the Lightning Network, because what it enables is in-flight currency exchange. Why do I need to be managing all of these foreign currencies if I can just choose which currency I want to receive and the exchange happens automatically with every payment? That's what this tech enables. And I'm so excited to be able to deliver that. As soon as there are multiple currencies in this, the floodgates are open.
Yeah, and in that sense, that's why networks are interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, each phone that is added to the network as a whole grows in value more so than necessarily that one user. And the same would apply with the more currencies that are going through this technology, the better. And it makes me think about my brother-in-law, Shada. He works for a business that does a lot of, it's a travel business, a stock-listed Australian travel business that is a flight aggregating platform. And they have another line of business, which was hotels in Europe. And they have a huge Aussie dollar exposure to different geographic locations. And he's got relationships from his finance department as a finance director with Citigroup, a big bank, and they're doing FX stuff all day long. It's like, well, I'll have to share this episode with him and see what he thinks. Like, how would this actually work in that real use case scenario? And I know that he owns some Bitcoin, but it's not necessarily something that the business has taken seriously yet. And such is the nature of where we're at in the adoption curve. It's like, you know, the leaders of the company are obviously looking at short-term volatility. That's a no, like we touched on already. And equally, like, we're functioning as a company, so what's the problem? How would you catch someone's attention that's working in that more traditional world with FX exposure, like real FX exposure that they need to get rid of? And that, you know, they're using swaps and options and all sorts of different stuff to do that.
I think it might be a bit awkward to say that that pain is going to go away. That full-time management of all of these different currencies may go away. What we have right now is $9.5 trillion that is transacted every single day. That's daily volume that is happening in foreign exchange markets. Wow. And that we actually have a shot at meaningfully disrupting that because we've got better technology that is faster, is more reliable, that doesn't have two-day rolling settlement around the world where you're at risk of holding all of these different currencies for too long than you want to, just because a bank is not going to be open on the weekends and that weekend is going to roll around the world.
Yeah, and the duration between Friday 5 p.m. and Monday 9 a.m., there could have been some macroeconomic issue or geopolitical instability that means that your Aussie dollar euro rate has drastically shifted since you received payment 48 hours before at no fault of your own. And that problem, for example, that exposure would go. Wow. And it's also that thing, isn't it, where we live in a world where the status quo is fiat central banks, and each country kind of has its own and they issue their own currency. And as a result, like, I follow FX rates. You know, I'm originally from the UK, but I'm looking at US dollars, I'm looking at euros, I'm looking at pounds, Aussie dollar, and just I'm always following, right? I now actually started pricing my assets in gold and in Bitcoin just as metrics, so that I've started. It's really interesting, you know, you move away from just the one fiat denominator and start looking on different metrics. But that whole FX market is as a result of all these different countries having different forms of money. It's like, well, if everyone was just using Bitcoin, you don't have an FX market.
No. Like, you're telling me that the $9.5 trillion per day that is being transacted on FX can't operate during the weekends in the age of the internet?
Yeah.
I mean, that's asking for disruption.
Wow.
When I can actually have in-flight currency exchange that happens with instant payments, where I don't need to trust any of the intermediate hops. Like that's the future, where I can do micropayments and I can pay AI systems. Like, what's holding us back from that? We have the technology. Now let's go serve that market because it sorely needs it. If you're holding a currency for too long during these geopolitical upsets, well, it's going to cause massive disruption. And, you know, businesses shouldn't be in trouble because of something that's happening in another part of the world just because they're stuck holding a currency that they don't want to hold.
Mm. And so, Jesse, I'm conscious of time. Another 10 minutes, okay?
Sure.
Yeah, cool. Thank you. Just to come back to the economics of running a node and managing channels, what we're talking through here is, okay, well, that's potentially an error for disruption. That's potentially an error for disruption. All of it, should it go the way that you're envisaging, equals more volume on Lightning. So to me, very clear green light, like learn more. Like that would be the first step, right? How does this stuff work? The headline grabbing yield number that was thrown around earlier on this year about like 10% yield is possible for a Lightning node. What are those numbers like in reality? And you already mentioned the fact that if you put too much capital into the system, you don't need that much right now. So it's obviously a balancing act between actual demand and capital deployment. So just, yeah, if we could go back to that, I'd love to understand like what kind of yields could you expect? And what might compress those over time and how big might it become?
Yeah. The big number that got thrown around was 9.7% coming from Cash App. You know, Miles Suter at, you know, Bitcoin Vegas, he announced that number. And it's a bit misleading because overall Cash App itself does, you know, $500 million worth withdrawals from Cash App over the Lightning Network. So Incredible volume. And it's all going through, you know, Block's node, which gives them an opportunity to capture a lot of routing fees that happen, not just on the withdrawals or maybe not on the withdrawals, whatever, but actually on the reversal. So because Lightning payments can flow both ways and they're capturing that flow. So it really has very little to do with the amount of capital that they've added to their node. So I have to separate those two things in my mind. It's not about how much capital you're bringing to the table. It is about how big of pipes you're creating on the Lightning Network, because once you've created a large pipe, well, now you can send large payments through there. So if we want to talk about enterprise settlement disruption, we're going to have to bring more capital to the Lightning Network to build those bigger pipes for those payments to flow. But at the end of the day, it's about payment volume. That is where the yield comes from. And so we're very focused on bringing more businesses to the Lightning Network to access cheaper payments, faster payments, avoiding all of the foreign exchange that they may currently have to deal with. And that can go away through a payments API integration.
And so, okay, if you have Bitcoin to allocate, which you're looking to earn a yield on in a non-custodial fashion, this is really cool, but you don't bring Cash App volume. I, for example, don't have a payments business to bring to the table. But there's a symbiosis there because one assumes that the payment processor actually doesn't necessarily want to deploy the capital that's necessary to run all the payments. And perhaps it is, as you've already clearly shown, it's about providing marketplaces to batch the two together. Yeah, wow. Okay. What a journey, Jesse. Did you ever expect... This will be my final question, I think, roughly. It's like when you set a vision and you have a direction that you're going in, sometimes it's hard to distinguish the difference between the destination and the journey. And so like, did you ever expect to be in the position you're in today? And like, how's that kind of played out?
I never expected this. I studied wastewater treatment in college.
You
didn't.
You're kidding me.
And which actually taught me concepts of liquidity and kind of the plumbing of the wastewater treatment system.
You're kidding me. Wow.
I'm not kidding. And then, I love that. You know, I've also done like asset management for highways, but it's Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt, Jesse. You don't know when a piece of information you receive is going to be useful. So it's this concept of non-linear productivity and intuition. Like something took you there. You don't know what, and suddenly you're studying wastewater management, and it turns out that the liquidity you learned there is useful building your business. How many? That's wild. Wow.
It's a very unpredictable journey. You know, we're doing our best to see as far in the future as we can. And we've got the, you know, praxeology that kind of looks at the incentives of the system to devise what the future will look like. But we can't predict everything. And so at every stage, we're playing our hand the best. You know, we can't really control which cards we're dealt, but we can be strategic about when to play those.
Mm. Yeah, cool. Well, I'm wishing you the very best of luck for the next phase, Jesse. I want to make one final shout out, which is to Phil from 21M Communications, putting us in touch. Very briefly, Jesse, what's it been like working with Phil, and why would you recommend him?
Shout out, Phil. Thank you so much for having me, Jake, and also for Phil. I get to chat with him once a week. It's an incredible experience. I get signal about what's happening in the Bitcoin and crypto worlds. What are news agencies focused on? And also, Phil gets me connected with all the people that can help carry my message and deliver, you know, my message through their networks and reach as many people as possible.
Awesome. Well, Jesse, you painted a picture today that I have to learn more, as I said to you just now. It's like, what is going on here and how might I be part of it? So I will let you know how the process goes. I signed up for the wait list with Rails, I think it is. So if there's any way of like bumping an email address further up the list, then I'd appreciate that. Otherwise, thank you so much for your time today and very best of luck with everything in the future.
Love it. Thank you so much, Jake.
Cheers, Jesse.